our guest has arrived. Well, what should I say? Happy Easter, Christos Voskres, Ivana.
Thank you very much for inviting me to speak with you today. Long time no see, indeed.
Absolutely. So it's terribly long. We shouldn't be missing you that much and for such long time.
Well, it depends actually how you analyze this, because I cannot wait for the war to be over, so we do not have to have those conversations, but rather to switch, you know, to some more positive and happy happy topics. But in the meantime, this is what it is, and I still believe it's tremendously important to face ugly realities as they are facing international security, unfortunately, nowadays.
Oh, 100%. And Ivana, we've been discussing it even last time when you were on, and that is quite some time ago. But last time when you were on, we were talked about the influence which China had at that point in time on Serbia. And at that point in time, they had sent some of their transport planes, which then delivered essentially goods to the Russians through Belgrade. Now, this morning, there were news yet again about the sincere and long-standing friendship between Serbia and China. The influence of our Kring axis of evil continues to grow. And Mr. Vucic, the former Minister of Information and Propaganda, sorry if I may say so, of Milosevic, he knows which game to play. He has a big violin for China, right?
Indeed. I often speak on your spaces about how Russia is influencing the Balkans, but actually China has also a very, very, very important place in the region. Just take a look, for example, during the vaccine diplomacy, during the pandemic, how Russia placed itself in the region and positioned itself as a savior with vaccines. So that was, you know, one of the ways. But in the meantime, China also invested tremendous resources in security issues, whether to make Belgrade as a smart city and to help the Serbian government in that respect, basically, you know, with the privacy issues and spying on its citizens, or with the latest delivery of Chinese weapons such as FK3 batteries. So to me, you know, a more concerning issue is certainly the question of security and how China wants to have a foothold in Europe, whether via Serbia or whether via Hungary. But you mentioned also the games that the president of Serbia has been playing. And indeed, one of his strategies as soon as he came to power was to play that balancing game between Beijing, Moscow, Brussels, and Washington. And has been, you know, quite successful in that field because he has been, you know, quite successful with that because, frankly, the West didn't pay that much attention to the Balkans. And he understood very, very early on that he can use that as a leverage to create problems both for the West, but also for China and Russia, playing that balancing strategy, claiming that eventually, you know, he wants to join the European Union, but not the European Union membership, but rather the European Union path. And it's, I always like to, you know, make jokes that I don't know what linguists are doing in the European Union if they don't have anyone to properly translate, that when the Serbian president is talking about the European Union, he's never talking about the EU membership. He always claims that he wants to be on the European Union path. And as a matter of fact, it's understandable why, because he needs money and he needs the European Union support to remain, you know, in power. And with the EU accession funds, he has been able to accomplish a lot of, you know, his goals. But I don't believe that, frankly, that he wants to join the European Union. It's not in his personal interest, which is that Serbia is becoming increasingly more and more authoritarian country. It's still not Belarus, but it's on its way. Like, you can literally read the latest reports about democracy declining, about human rights violations, about media freedom. It's very, very concerning. That's, you know, the one part of the story. And the second part of the story is that he also needs China and Russia to use that as a leverage with the European Union. So last week, I don't know if you saw that even the president of Serbia basically made very inappropriate statements saying, you know, that I'm a mentally deranged person.
He has it in for you. He really likes to poke at you. Why is that, Ivana? Does he have such a low level of self-esteem that he needs to lash out at someone who lives in a free country and is essentially more patriotically involved in the freedom of the Serbian culture and people? What is it with you, Ivana, that he likes so much that he needs to lash out at you?
I mean, look, it's not that I'm important. As a matter of fact, they have a friend, you know, who called me right after and he said, look, you're a very good friend. You're smart, but you're a totally irrelevant academic. But actually, you know, he made a joke and he said, like, it's unbelievable that the president of a country pays, you know, that much attention to you. And not only him, like, but also like the Russian government, which is hilarious. And here is why. It's not because I'm saying something outrageous or I'm a threat, you know, to their regime. It's rather because authoritarian leaders, they fear ideas. They hate people who are independent thinkers, and they consider anyone who thinks differently to be a threat to their thinking and as a traitor. And President Vučić has a long history of being surrounded by people who mirror his views, and those who do not, they're punished. So the reason, you know, why he was upset is in part because they claim, you know, that the Chinese president was planning to visit Serbia. And I said, you know, how President Vučić is going to use BRICS now as a bargaining chip against the West. So as I said, you know, it really didn't come as a surprise that he lashed out like that. It's just a different, you know, mentality, different culture. And I always laugh, you know, when people in the West think that, I don't know, people like Putin or other similar leaders are strong. They're not very resilient people. The very first fact, you know, that they spend time, energy, resources on irrelevant academics is tells you all you really need to know about them. But to go back to the question of the current visit, it certainly has a lot to do with investments, but I'm also very, very concerned about security issues and maybe new deals related to weapons delivery and other things related to making a Belgrade another smart city, because with the rise in authoritarian regime in Belgrade, we can actually see more and more ties to Beijing and Moscow. But also, as I said, I don't think that Vučić plans to join per se BRICS, but he's definitely going to use that as a bargaining chip. But it's not only, you know, China, what is currently happening in the Balkans writ large is also very concerning, because not many people actually pay attention to the region. And when you see more and more articles and news about potential crisis in the region, it is actually very concerning. Right now, there are two pressing issues over there. One is in the United Nations, the UN General Assembly resolution related to Srebrenica. And the other thing is Kosovo's membership to the Council of Europe. In both events, Serbia, with the help of Russia and China, are using to diminish the West, to undermine the West, and to position themselves as a basically victims of the West. So when it comes to the resolution, the Srebrenica resolution in the United Nations, immediately the government of Serbia, as well as Milorad Dodik from Republika Srpska in Bosnia and Herzegovina, stated that it will be a catalyst for another chaos in the region and potential war. And let me just remind you that Mr. Dodik, who has been threatening with the secession of Republika Srpska, he continued, you know, with his threats, basically claiming that Republika Srpska is on the verge of its independence.
Which is what we would see yet again as cooking up the conflict and leading to a immediate action by both the international observers, as well as the people who don't necessarily want that, right?
I mean, that's literally the last thing that the West needs right now. And Putin knows that. I mean, Milorad Dodik, he was just recently in Moscow. He was awarded by the Russian government. All those things are truly, you know, nothing new. What is new is that you are going to have elections in the European Union, elections here in the United States, that are very important, and Putin does not need to roll on tanks in any of those countries. Because, look, let me just remind you something that very few people actually know in the West. Last May, the May of 2023, Serbia actually clashed, the Serbs clashed with the NATO peacekeepers in Kosovo. 90 NATO peacekeepers were injured. 90. What did the West do? Nothing. And it's understandable why. Because by just, you know, putting all those things under the rug and pretending nothing happened, it was something that I expected. Because what is the alternative? They're going to say what? Like, we are now in a war. What are we going to do? Are they going to, you know, start a war with a landlocked country and over there? No. Just a few months later, you had another event in Banska where several people also died. And that was the round one. And I do believe that right now they're preparing for a round two. As a matter of fact, when you see the Russian government media, but also Telegram channels, openly talking about the West opening a new front, it means that they're already setting informational conditions for another round. So there are two vulnerable spots in the Balkans. One is Kosovo, and the second one is Bosnia and Herzegovina. When it comes to Kosovo, I have to also admit that I'm a little bit more positive today than I was a few months ago, in part because numerous countries, including the United Kingdom, but also Germany, that announced the increase of NATO peacekeepers over there, that is a step in the right direction. Now, the very first fact that there are more and more NATO peacekeepers, it doesn't mean that things cannot escalate, because it's not the question of the number of NATO peacekeepers, it's rather whether they have authority or not, you know, to respond to any escalation. And that's something that we should continue to monitor. When it comes to Bosnia and Herzegovina, that's a little bit more tricky, because even though Mr. Dodik, he does not have powerful army behind him, it still doesn't mean that he cannot announce secession, and I'll explain why. Oftentimes, you know, I hear in the West, you know, it's irrational for Serbia or Republika Srpska, you know, to do all those sorts of things. You know, the question of rationality and how we in the West do cost-benefit analysis, it's one thing. Something else is when you understand the culture, identity politics, ethnic tensions. Unfortunately, not everyone in the West comprehends how those dynamics work. And now there are two things that I want to emphasize. Number one thing is, does Russia actually need to send its troops or military in the region? No, they don't. Because Putin is not operating in the region with hard power. He's operating through intelligence and through its proxies. So think about what happened last year in September with the Binska incident. Think about special operation forces and something what we can call like a little green man that can destabilize and challenge or escalate, however you want to call it, whether in Kosovo or in Bosnia-Herzegovina. And then to make sure, you know, that the West does not respond, because there is the question also of plausible deniability.
And we know this. We know this because our boys are actually serving even on Serb territory. We know that they are constantly bringing Spetsnaz into the various places. They had a training facility close to Novi Sad. The West is aware of all of this, but we're not discussing it in public. Because if we were to do something, as Ben Hodges recently stated, when you have acknowledged that there is a problem, you're obligated to do something about it.
To do something, exactly. And that's why I told you, I totally understand. I'm not justifying this. I'm the one who has been voicing this for the past 1 year, you know, when you had like a 90 NATO peacekeepers that were injured last year. So you're absolutely right. When you acknowledge something, you have to do something about that, and you don't know what to do. But it's not only, as I mentioned, like Kosovo, but also Bosnia. So explain like how Russia is operating. And not only that, I'm sure that some of our listeners today have heard of a famous Russian Telegram channel called Raibar, which is a military, basically, channel. And that channel is particularly interesting because I've been watching like Russia's influence operations for a very long time. And every time before the escalation, Raibar channel suddenly becomes very active. And when you have like a Raibar channel talking about the West opening a second front, it tells you all you need to know. But it doesn't stop and end there. Several weeks ago, Raibar channel opened a media school in Serbia and in Republika Srpska. And that tells you all you need to know, because in Russia's security strategy, how do you understand a hybrid war? It's not only through the kinetic use of force, but always informational conditions that they set prior to that. So they claim, you know, they took 10 projects on. They're teaching people how to use Telegram channel. They're teaching people, you know, how to conduct those influence operations. And why that matters? For several reasons. Number one, very few people in the West actually speak, with all due respect, any of those languages in the region. The Balkans, it's immensely, immensely complex because of different religion dynamics, different ethnic groups, different ethnic tensions, identity politics, etc. And who has information superiority is going to win that war. And Russia is already positioning itself for that.
They have an easier or simpler access to the languages in the region. There are still a lot more interlocutors who speak Russian. There is, the pan-Slavic belief in the Serbs, in the Serb society is still massive. So for the Russians, it's significantly easier in terms of adhesiveness. But on the other hand, in Canada and in the US, where you are, there are huge numbers of emigres from all, literally all parts of the Balkans. There's not a single minority or not a single group of ethnicity from the Balkans which is not represented in the United States. Technically, we should be able to recruit more than enough people of goodwill and smarts and skills and experience to get a better understanding. Why on earth are we failing on this matter, Ivana?
Well, the answer is very, very simple. That is because the Balkan has not been on the agenda for a very long time. And the West is always acting reactionary in the region. And Russia has been investing tremendous resources, especially for the past 10 years in the region. So it's not that a lot of people actually speak Russian language. As a matter of fact, Ukrainian is much easier to understand than Russian, by the way, if you're speaking like a Serbian language.
Absolutely.
I never took a single class in Ukrainian language and understand almost everything. So we should not use that as an excuse. The thing is that there is a political issue there, that the Serbian president has positioned himself as a source of stability in the region, which means that he's the one who always escalates and then de-escalates the crisis and then positions himself as a source of stability in the eyes of the West. So basically, he's blackmailing the West, saying, if you do not support me, you will have a conflict in the region, when, as a matter of fact, he's the one who is putting the Balkans on fire and then using every possible tool to decrease fire. That's exactly what he has been doing with Mr. Dodik, for example, using him to escalate the crisis, and then he positioned himself as a mediator to calm down the situation in the region. Why? To remain in power. And having said that, the West is in a very uncomfortable situation right now because they do not want to upset him in any way. They do not want to invest tremendous resources in offensive information operations or to counter malign foreign influence, in part also not to upset him because they believe that he's the only one who can regulate the region and who can bring the Balkans towards the European Union. And for our listeners who understand the history of the Balkans, his dream is to position himself as Tito, Josip Broz Tito, you know, from the former Yugoslavia, someone who can balance between East and the West. But the thing is, the good news is that there are more and more people in the West who are waking up and who understands that he has been in power for more than a decade. He hasn't delivered anything. So,
he still is so much. Ivana, apologies. Is mm-hmm. it fair to say that Mr. Vucic and his government are not only now, of course, opening to even more pro-Russian and pro-Chinese and heavy-duty security force-trained people on the one hand, but they've always been in touch with their deeper Milosevic-type Serb, shall we say, suprematist kind of movement. It comes naturally to him. It's not something which he had to learn for a nihilistic kind of power grab. He actually tends to believe in this.
Two things. Number one is that currently there is a new government in Serbia, and two people in the government, the ministers, are sanctioned by the United States. The former chief of the Serbian intelligence, who has very, very strong ties to Russia and who recently received an award from the Russian security apparatus, which tells you all you need to do, all you need to know, is back in the government. So Serbia has not abandoned its strong ties to Russia. The second point is that the president of Serbia, who was what you just mentioned at the very beginning of our conversation, who was the minister of information during the Milosevic regime, is back in his is back in power, and he's also an ideologue. Yes, he is just like a, for example, Orban, who loves, you know, money and who loves to balance between East and West. Certainly that is correct. But also, he's an ideologue and he's just waiting for the right time to accomplish his goals. The third point, Mr. Vulin, who I just mentioned earlier today, who was the former chief of Serbian intelligence sanctioned by the United States, who has very strong ties to Russia, who praised people like Patrushev and Narishkin, he was actually inviting the concept of the Serbian world, which is equivalent to the Russian world, where all Serbs would live under the same cultural framework. That thing has not left the orbit. As a matter of fact, a few
only
days
Serbs,
ago,
Ivana, only Serbs?
That's the idea. Yeah, I mean, it's called like the Great Serbia, like the, you know, the very similar, like the Serbian world, similar to the Russian world concept. Several days ago, Mr. Dodik, the Serbian Orthodox Church, as well as President Vucic were supposed to have an event to discuss exactly that cultural framework. Exactly and precisely that cultural framework. And then because of the UN resolution on Srebrenica, they decided to postpone it and claim, you know, let's see what's going to happen in the UN and then we are going to see how to proceed. So that is the game plan. So there is also an ideology part of it. But you have to go back to the real problem. There are two problems with the West. Number one is, you know, what one of my colleagues said perfectly. He said the West has put a bar so low on the Balkans that any tiny win, they present as a big win. I'll just give you a very concrete example. Every time when the Serbian government votes in favor in the United Nations supporting Ukraine, they represent that as a win, when in fact it's not a win. Because, this, first of all, those UN General Assembly resolutions are not binding. And second thing is the reason why the Serbian president pushes for those resolutions, it is because he claims, because Kosovo, they claim, is the part of Serbia, then Crimea must be part of Ukraine. But those are completely, you know, irrelevant things compared to how Serbia and Russia cooperate in security matters. And recently, you know, with China. So, and what you also mentioned, and I couldn't agree more with you, when you acknowledge that you have a problem, what are you going to do about that? Given that in Serbia, unfortunately, there is no any feasible pro-Western opposition, the logic is, well, we have to deal with Vucic because there is no alternative. It's not like in Georgia that you have thousands and thousands of people on the street waving EU flags and begging the West to help them getting rid of Russia's influence. So the situation in the region is definitely not that great.
Ivana, can you tell this to our audience? And as you know, we have a global audience from people listening in at a very, very early time in Japan, all across Europe and the US. Can you tell people just briefly, so that they get their heads around it, as to what the cultural setup currently is? There's a number of nations which escaped the former Yugoslavia. They escaped the wars of the 1990s. Some of them have joined the EU. Others have not quite yet. There's associations and the likes. What is the overall setup? Serbia, meaning the current, however we want to call it, this current conundrum, and then the Republika Srpska face. And why does it matter so much to the Balkans what they face?
I mean, look, after 2000...
I know, it's a simple question. It's one of the questions. We could talk for 24 hours, but...
Exactly.
Make sure that people understand what the problem is.
Okay, so basically, it literally serves at least three extra spaces to have like several hours long to explain dynamics. But in a nutshell, we'll do it here. Yes. So, but basically, this is a story in a nutshell. After 2000 and the revolution that was supposed to bring democracy, and Serbia aligning itself more towards the European Union, the whole process of that alignment has been very slow and meandering, in part because of the previous government that was not very efficient, but I don't want to even talk in details about that because it's very complex as well. And then when Vucic came to power, he made sure, you know, to balance that between East and West, but he hasn't done any concrete steps to bring actually Serbia closer to the European Union and the West. And the way that he is operating, it's fascinating regarding that Serbian, the Serbian world equivalent to the Russian world. For example, the way he does not need to use bullets to accomplish his strategic goals in the region, because just look at Montenegro, which is NATO member state, where right now, unfortunately, the sentiment is that less people support NATO today than several years ago. And that is because pro-Serbian nationalistic groups have played a tremendously important role in the country. And you should definitely pay attention to North Macedonia, which is another NATO member state. With the newest elections, I'm confident to say that Serbia is going to play a tremendously important role to make sure to destabilize. And this is why. Just like as Putin fears democracy in his neighborhood, the Serbian president also fears democracy in his neighborhood. And by destroying democracy in the region and putting an end towards the European Union and NATO integration of all other countries, he can use that as a leverage with the West. And that's his game plan, to position himself as the only one who can bring region closer to the West by escalating and then de-escalating, when in fact, that is not the case. When it comes to Republika Srpska and Milorad Dodik, it's a very similar strategy. He has been threatening with the secession for a long time. A lot of people believe these are just, you know, empty words. I don't believe that these are just, you know, empty words, because the logic coming from the West is when you do a cost-benefit analysis, it makes no sense to do it. He has no power. He has no manpower to wage a war, et cetera, et cetera. All he really needs to do, just as Vucic did last year, is to escalate the crisis and then to show that the West is a paper tiger and unwilling to do something about that. It is not about the Western. It is not about Serbia's or Russia's strength. It's rather about the Western unwillingness to act. So they know this thing.
This is, why on earth do we not learn? We've learned this in so many other theaters. We actually understand this. You and I discussed this many times before. Ben talks about this. And we know that the Russian tactic is to constantly push the fence, test us, annoy us, check out where we're weak, where we're not reacting, so they can push further, so they can convince a few more gullibles to play their game and the likes. Why on earth do we not react like, for example, Helmut Half, a wonderful German general, Brigade General Half, did at that point in time in Kosovo, and just send, seriously, put your foot down and push them back?
Why?
It's not that difficult, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Correct. Look, we are talking about tiny landlocked country such as Serbia that is playing the West like a fiddle. It is disgraceful and shameful. I totally agree with you. But look, you're talking about, in an ideal scenario, what we should have done. The West fears escalations. Today, Russia has threatened to test tactical nukes. If you're sitting here in Washington, D.C., and listening to some of the leaders and some of policymakers in Washington, D.C., they genuinely fear escalations. They genuinely fear nuclear weapons threats, when in part, it is a very, very important part of Russia's psychological warfare targeting the West. So,
and we have defanged this. We defanged this approach many times. We've debunked it, we dissected it, we went through it. And there's great people in the DOD and in Washington you speak to at the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. You have absolutely perfect experts in that regard. But why on earth is this not permeating
in
the media?
As I said, people in the West fear escalation, period. That has been an agenda for a long time. We experienced that with Ukraine. We experienced that in the past. So this is nothing new. To put this in the context of the Balkans, but before I do that, in 2024, I actually want to remind you what happened back in the 90s when we experienced the unipolar world, the end of the Cold War, and when there was no China and Russia to challenge the West. Even then, the West was played by people such as Milosevic, who also positioned himself as a source of stability in the region, escalating and then de-escalating. It took the West 5 years to start truly doing something in the region to prevent atrocities. We are talking about a unipolar moment when there was no China and Russia. Today, with China, Russia, North Korea, and Iran, who are a new axis of evil, the last thing that the West wants is to provoke another chaos. But the truth is, their weakness is provoking chaos. Russia, along with its proxies in the region, tested the West last year, and there were no repercussions. I mean, you literally had U.S. government who argued that the president of Serbia was a partner. No repercussions. I have no idea, you know, what they are saying behind the closed doors, but I'm telling you what they are talking publicly. And I also saw that the European Union awarded Serbia with more funds, when in fact, all those funds are ordinary people are not benefiting from. But to go back, kindness is weakness for authoritarian leaders, and weakness emboldens them. You and me, and I'm confident to say a lot of our listeners today, will agree with us. But unfortunately, given the EU elections and the elections in the United States, the last thing that I want is actually new escalation. And what I'm very concerned about is that that sort of weakness is going to invite more escalations and to show that the West is a paper tiger.
The funny thing is that behind that paper tiger, actually inside that paper tiger setup, there is still a sleeping tiger. It's the problem that we don't wake it up, right? And why on earth would we fear ourselves? It is something which, I mean, we had this discussion here with Mick Ryan. We had it with Philip Breedlove, and also with Ben, that it is illogical. Our behavior is so disconnected from what we've experienced and what we've learned in the last hundreds of years. It makes very little sense. Where is this illogical fear coming from? What do you think?
There are two things. Look, before moving to Washington, D.C., I was in academia. I was very much away from decision-making processes. I very much like to think about those abstract big ideas. But then as soon as I moved to Washington, D.C., I realized all the theories that I've been teaching my students were not very helpful, because number one theory that everyone should teach students is actually leaders make decisions in large part to benefit their own career. And bureaucracy, whether in Washington, whether in Brussels or elsewhere, awards risk aversion. The last thing that you need is to shake the status quo. And having said that, a lot of people, decision makers, are just thinking how to survive on a four-year period, election circles. Meanwhile, Russia, China, North Korea, Iran, they do not have to think in those terms. They have a long-term strategy that they execute. And having said that, I'm absolutely not surprised to see why risk aversion pays off. And that is something that is going to cost us a lot, that already has costed us a lot in Ukraine. And whoever believes that this war is going to end in Ukraine is sorely mistaken. Just look at this. Russia is already at war with the United States. But we cannot say it out loud because, again, if we acknowledge that, what are we going to do about that? You had the report about the Havana Syndrome. Just recently, there was another report on how Russia plans to use intelligence, whether, you know, to blow up like a different places in Europe, et cetera, et cetera. Or the third thing is where Putin openly stated a few weeks ago in his speech that he will go after Russian opposition in the West. Not because only, you know, he wants to punish those people, but rather by intimidating them, or I hope it will not happen, but it might also happen, assassinating them to make sure that the West is not going to respond. And all these things are part of Russia's hybrid warfare. Putin has been weaponizing migration. Putin has been filling the blank. Russia does not need to use tanks and jets to challenge the West. And unless we understand this war through Putin's perspective, we are not going to win. And I want to emphasize one more thing. The more risk-averse we are, the more Kremlin is going to benefit this from. So having said that, we are already in the hybrid war with Russia. Putin has openly basically claimed, you know, that he is in the war with the West. I genuinely don't understand what part of that message the West does not understand. Some people do, but as we just discussed earlier, where you acknowledge that, you need to do something about that.
A friend of ours, Keir Giles, last week when we spoke here about it, repeated the notion that, and this is consistent with what Ben highlights all the time, that we may not like to be at war. We may not think that we should be at war. We may not even believe that we are at war, but Russia is at war with us.
Correct.
And some of its allies are very happy to support that war on oh so many levels, some more openly, some more in a hidden fashion, some more indirectly, you know, China. And we need to acknowledge the fact that there is a war ongoing. Failing to name it makes it impossible for the elites in the West to communicate with the electorate about that war, correct?
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more with you that without acknowledging that we are already in the war with Russia, we cannot fix it. That's number one thing. And second thing is, unless we understand how Russia's military perceives conflicts, we cannot also win this war, because we are always going to start with wrong assumptions. Russia's military understands conflict in a very different way from the way that we understand it here. And again, you have to start with same assumptions. I know that this piece is in particular, it's not about cybersecurity, but as I mentioned multiple times in your spaces, in Russia's language, there is not even a word cybersecurity. They use it information security. They use only cybersecurity when you talk about Western cybersecurity, because their understanding information security is much broader. They include both the technical part, let's say attacks on critical infrastructure, but also psychological part, which is influence operations. They're just, you know, one of the examples. Second thing is, when it comes to hybrid war, just recently need to openly acknowledge that Russia is waging a hybrid war. Okay, and then what are we going to do about that? So unfortunately, for these spaces, I'm not delivering any good news. Again, this time, I'm just asking more questions and bringing more facts on the ground that are not going in the right direction. As I said, you're just observing how brave people of Georgia are fighting Russia's influence there. I would not be surprised to see more chaos in Moldova around the elections. As I just mentioned, make no mistakes, but there will be another escalation also in the Balkans, just below the threshold of war. And make no mistakes also that Russia will not stop at its hybrid war activities in the West. They announced it. We have U.S. intelligence that the Western intelligence that they just published over the past few days, Russia's plans, and let alone Russia's goals for the global South, because I cannot find a better term, what they're doing in Latin America or in Africa and humiliating the West. Kindness is weakness for Putin. And until we understand that, we'll still be in this situation. I have just a few minutes left because I need to run for another meeting. But if there are any other questions, I'm happy to answer for the next 3 or 4 minutes.
Excellent. And that's perfect. And thank you, Ivana, for that. Lexicon, you have a question.
Yeah, well, I'm just listening to Ben Hodges yesterday, a recent conversation he had with a Czech journalist. So we know one of the strengths of Ben is he's very, very hones in very finely, focuses on what is the objective of specific action. He decried, of course, in this interview, the terrible statement after the Ukraine aid package finally went of good old Jeff Sullivan, who said it's going to keep Ukraine in the war. And he said, I think that's a terrible statement. So he discussed further in that interview, I'm trying to take you back to what you're saying about the demand that our leaders recognize what's going on. So he looked at the question of France deciding that we really should have maintain a strategic ambivalence as far as, or whatever, no, uncertainty, whatever, incertitude, as far as Russia is concerned. We should not be broadcasting to them what we will not do, and so on. And he said he absolutely agrees with this stance. And when the interviewer, on the part of Macron, the journalist asked him about whether he could see the possibility of NATO troops going into Ukraine for any reason. And he said, yes. But one thing he made, first of all, very clear. I mean, he said, absolutely, that's possible. But he said, we could go in to do a number of things. And we've heard those things indicated by various people. But he said, with the condition that our policymakers make clear what is the objective? What is the goal? So just as they don't, I mean, he doesn't even call on America, on NATO, to recognize that Russia is at war with us. He calls on them to say, what's our objective in Ukraine? If somebody in NATO, some country wishes to send troops in to support Ukraine on the Belarus border or to handle logistics, it has to be articulated clearly by our policymakers. That's the first step, and then you reinforce it with strength. So I'm saying that although it's a huge ask that these folks ever go so far as to acknowledge an actual war, but to acknowledge specific necessities in one theater, and I'm sure you could enunciate them for parts of the Balkan theater, but he calls constantly for NATO to enunciate the, or for U.S. and Germany to enunciate a policy that we're supporting Ukraine so that it will win. And so I think it's good to focus on those, you could call them more limited elements of the conflict, even though we'll never get them to admit the broad scale of it. I don't know if you could make a comment on that.
Absolutely. Number one problem, in my view, is that U.S. government has never acknowledged or articulated what the victory in Ukraine means for the West and for Ukraine as well. It is all about, you know, we are going to support Ukraine as long as it takes. And we are just helping Russia with that, because one of the key things that Putin has been trying to do is to make this war a protracted war. And that also brings me back to my initial point regarding escalation. When we delivered Javelin, Putin, the Kremlin immediately threatened with escalation in the West. Every weapon that we delivered, they use threats. Today, they have threatened with testing tactical nukes. And that's the part of Russia's, what they call in Russia's military reflexive control, basically how to feed your opponent with information that your opponent believes it's actually benefiting benefiting him or herself, but it's actually benefiting your enemy. And Russia is a master at it. Like Russia's most powerful weapon is truly information and psychological warfare, and how they are playing the West like a fiddle with the fear of escalation. Because Putin understands very well, especially among older generation people, remember the Cold War, and that triggers a lot of, you know, anxieties. Some of us, you know, who experienced wars, like we take security. We do not take security for granted. We understand security from a different perspective. And we also understand escalation from a different perspective. Also, if you understand culture and mentality. And if you read like how Russia in the past dealt with its own enemies through powerful rhetorics and followed through on its commitment, that's something that we should actually take into consideration, you know, how to understand Russia's threats. As a matter of fact, as I said, Putin will only be stopped, will only stop if we stop him. Weakness emboldens Putin, and we already saw that in the past. Putin wants to make this war a protracted war, and until we articulate clearly that we are there to help Ukraine win this war, Putin is going to win. And my last point on that is, if Russia's military strategists believe that who has information superiority will win this war, we better believe it. And we better understanding through those lenses. I'm going to stop there. And Axel, I need to leave in a minute. Voila. But I want to thank everyone for your time to be here. And I very much look forward to seeing you again soon, hopefully with better and more positive news. In the meantime, pay attention to Russia's hybrid warfare activities against the West, but also how Russia is using its toolkit in its neighborhood, but also in places such as Georgia, Moldova, and the Balkans, and pay attention to potential escalations around the elections.
Excellent. Ivana, thank you so much, Ivana. Much appreciated. Everybody, please give a big hand to Ivana Stratner, magnificent expert and all-around good person, trying to highlight what we should be doing in order to make sure that we live in freedom in the future. Ivana, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.